This podcast is from heptagonclub.co.uk and paulcarenza.com. The Heptagon Club.
Heptagon Club.
Heptagon Club with Paul Carenza. 7 guests, 7 corners.
On this week's show,
some people, some other people, and some other people. 7 fantastic guests in 7 lovely corners.
And your host,
Mr. Paul Carenza.
Hello, podcast listeners. It's Paul Carenza here. Welcome to the Heptagon Club. In theory, this is a joyous Christmas special. In practice, this is one of those episodes where I tell you that I had it ready to go, all edited, all about to go, and then, well, Audacity, the program I used to edit this, decided to not only delete everything, but to save that as deleted. And much as I've tried on the internet, my limited knowledge has not enabled me to recover that otherwise finished podcast. So I'm denied what to do. Do I just not put anything out right now because it's Christmas and I've kind of got stuff to do? And I don't mean that as kind of like, well, there's always time to podcast. I'm having a corneal transplant in a day's time. I'm having someone else's cornea for Christmas and hopefully for life. That's the theory. So I'm going to be unable to see anything for a few days or weeks from about 48 hours time. So there's a bit of a deadline, obviously, to try and get this podcast out. I wanted to put something out there just before Christmas, because I've got this Christmas podcast ready to go. So anyway, my point is I'm going to try and cobble something together. We're going to try and get 7 guests on. It may not be the beautifully finished product that is now being lost to the recycle bin forevermore. Oh, that's the point. Have I checked the recycle bin? I have. It's not there. So we have got 7 guests. We've got Jimmy Cricket this week, and we have various other people that I will be making sure we can hear between now and the end of this podcast. And then, as I say, from here, I will go forth and have some lovely pre-Christmas surgery. And we've got some jingle bells, by the way, just to, there you go, tell you it's Christmas. And all the chat is coming in, so we better get in Mr. Jimmy Cricket, our first Christmas guest.
Jimmy Cricket, Sir Jimmy of Cricket. Actually, you have a papal knighthood. Is that
correct? Yes. It means I've got to, Paul, defend the poor, look after the vulnerable, protect the Holy See from the grim forces of evil. But first, a song.
Absolutely. I figured you couldn't help yourself, couldn't you? The eternal showman that you are, absolutely.
It's like the great Vera Lynn. Harry Seacombe used to say she sang the Nazis to death, you know.
So you, when did you start performing? When did you start doing comedy shows?
You can hear the tap dancing in folks there. Yeah. Well, it wasn't when I was a kid in Belfast. We had a shop. My mum and dad, and I used to go out and do all Jolson, will you believe it? So it's just something must have been in the genes. I mean, how on earth could a 3-year-old know about Al Jolson unless they were...
So you were 3?
When I look back, And of course, the mum and dad were slightly a little bit embarrassed, so they didn't... Because the shop went onto living quarters, you see. So I would appear in between the living quarters. The customers found this incredible, but the mum and dad said, get in there, you know. Yeah. And then I sort of, my father and my elder brother used to take me to the local theatres there, the Grand Opera House, and there's another one called The Empire, and I used to see shows and just the whole thing. They had orchestras then, you see. It was twice nightly variety. Dickie Valentine would come out, he'd be the top, but he'd only do half an hour. You would have Mickey and Griff, a country duo on, then there'd be jugglers, Martin Fraser's harmonica guy. You'd get the extra like 10 minutes, just 11 or 12. Billy Dinty would be doing his eccentric. It was just 2.25 hours of pure escapism, really. All accompanied by an orchestra. Mm. 7 or 8 piece. And you know something, Paul? The actual MD, Mr. Cooney, was at the school I was at, St. Patrick's, and I could have learnt recording and all that. You know, you talk about sometimes you think you could kick yourself. Mm. He was this great man, and I could have learnt and then gone to the shows and things and maybe befriended him and got into show business earlier.
Yeah, exactly. You could have cut a few years off.
Yeah, didn't you? I took the long route.
Yes. Well, you say the long route. I mean, you've been performing now for however many decades, I don't know. But
I always sort of think it. I became a Redcoat and Buttons in Ireland. Okay. I was transferred over here. So the early 20s were Redcoat and Bluecoat days. Mm. If you didn't include them, I went full time when I was about mid-20s, 26, 20, when I met my good lady. She was 16 at the holiday camp. She's with us tonight, bless her, cotton picking socks. And so we've been married 42 years, but we've known each other 44, so I would really be a full-time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good work, good work.
Yeah, yeah, well, you hang on in, you know, and we just loved every minute of the peaks and the troughs, really, of it all. Really.
Well, I remember, without wanting to age anybody, I remember when I was a boy, I had your joke books.
Letters from my mammy.
Yeah, letters to your mammy. Absolutely. All that stuff, all that stuff. I had it all, you know, so it's great stuff.
I'd always had a nursing sort of write and a little bit and sing a little bit, and I juggled a bit when I was small, but I never did it in the halcyon days, but I brought it back into the act, doing it in the comedy way. I always did the eccentric dancing because one of my favourites was Billy Dainty. I love physical comedy, you see, Paul, and so I just developed that a bit, and to be more an all-round entertainer, that was a nice thing for me. And that meant I was goal-orientated.
Sure, you know. Sure, yeah. Well, that's the nice thing about you know, because you're right. It is obviously, you know, the comedy is through it, you know, in the DNA, of course. But there is, you know, there's songs, there's jokes and stories and all that sort of thing as well. And it's, I think it's so refreshing to see, you know, this idea about the variety. It's still there, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
You know, Britain's got talents, things like that. America's got talents.
Very much so. There. I think do people do that? There'll always be a sort of an inkling for it. I mean, fashions change and things. But then you take Circus Soleil. I mean, they rebranded it and it became a whole new... They put a narrative on to circus acts and made them, you know, part of the story. As long as we can be creative, we can always keep something... Can rebrand it, really,
absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
So, Jimmy, delight to welcome a comedy legend to the Heptagon Club. So the idea, if you haven't heard us before, seven guests, seven corners. Like I said, I'm in kind of a sombre mood because we did have this podcast good to go. But Christmas, the show must go on, and we have a show for you here, including a QI elf. So that would be quite nice. I've had a very busy old time of it as well myself. I've been writing the BBC Music Awards script. If you follow me on Facebook or Twitter, you'll see the year in review poem that I put out there, which was voiced by Danny Dyer, of all people. So that was very nice. If you haven't had a chance to find it, have a look online. I've handed in a book for next Christmas that's due out as well, about a whole history of Christmas. 60,000 words on that. So we'll be trying to maybe spruce the odd Christmas fact or two throughout this episode as well. So we'll see how that goes. Right now, that let's we talk about variety for Mr. Cricket there. This is a very much the new variety, is this podcast. We have, in fact, a guest with a guitar over here, Gav Milnethorpe. Hi, Gav.
Hi, Paul. I know you're interested in receiving some fascinating Christmas facts. So
yeah, we've got some facts. That's fantastic.
I've got one for you. I bet you don't know. Did you know that the lovely traditional British Christmas carol, Silent Night, wait for it, it's actually German. Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht.
Yeah, I did know that.
Oh, you did know that. Okay. All right. Well, you may not know that some of our other favourite traditional British Christmas carols are also German, such as Away in a Manger. That's German. Im Stall in der Krippe, nein, weige Austrau. Bratwurst von Deutschmark, all wieder in Bär. And Hark the Herald Angels Sing, that's German too. Schnaps, Volkswagen, Schadenfreude, das schon Strudelflugelhorn. Indeed, even one of the nation's favourite Christmas pop hits is actually a cover version, having been originally penned in 1848 by Baron Cliff von Rickard.
Weihnachtszeit, die Mistel und Wein, Schnauze, Schnitzel, Kindersurprise, Vorsprung durch Technik, Albert Einstein, Gluten und Grubes, Little Tank.
So there you go. Bet you've learnt something right there.
Brilliant. Learned a lot. Thank you there, Gav.
One thing I was recalling was that you were in Peter Kay's video, weren't
yes.
you? For the 500 miles, wasn't it? Is that right?
That's right. Well, Peter, the phone rang one day, and this is nothing, way before 500 days and before Peter, and it was Peter on the phone,
And he said, oh, my mother's from Cookstown. See, we're a real Tyrone. I was born in Tyrone. When I told you about the shop, I moved when I was two. The whole family moved to Belfast. Mm. But we're really Tyrone people. And his mum, he said, is from Tyrone. He said, I was on with your son last night, Frankie. Our Frankie,
oh, yes,
comedian, yeah. Frankie Mulgrew, who became a priest, who's a Catholic priest now. And we're so proud. He's on great. He's chaplain in the local hospital and everything. He's fabulous. But when people pass, actually, the church on a Sunday, the laughter that comes out, people have to look twice to see that it's a church. You know, and you notice homilies, because he brings props and everything, you know. Oh, he's incredible. Yeah. So, right, just to bring that back. And he said, I was on with your son last night, and he promised to send me a CD of Steve Martin. Oh, yeah. The Great American. I said, oh, I'll tell him about that. Yeah. And then I pitched him about a charity show. Frank already mentioned it. I said, well, would you do this? And da-da-da-da-da. And he did. He brought his mum along, and that was the early days. That's, so I suppose, Peter, when you befriend people. I remember meeting John Bishop once on the beach in Turkey, would you believe it, with his son. And we chatted about life, and then he did a thing called Stand Up Thing, and they bring you. Life is always one big network, isn't it?
It is. It's who you bump into.
Who you see. It's all about it.
It really is. It really is.
So the moral of the story is, be nice to people.
You're right. Actually, every job I've ever had, certainly in the writing world, has been from the one job I did originally for writing. It's all the people you've met and being nice. Often it was...
People want to work with
you. Know, I've had two jobs where I've got the job because I didn't go to the toilet. And I was, you know, thinking, I need the loo. Oh, there's someone over. Hello, how are you? Got the loo. The lesson is, hold it in.
Speaking of charity singles, Jimmy Cricket has got one out for Christmas. Santa, bring my wellies back to me. Google it, do find it. All for a good cause as well. Now, joining Jimmy in Name Droppers Inglenook is returning guest comedian Dave Thompson.
One of our corners on this in our podcast party here is Name Dropping Corner.
Oh, right.
And
okay.
I, just knowing people you've worked with in the past, I imagine you may have...
Well, I'm not one to name drop, but...
Well, exactly, but given that I'm going to encourage you to...
Well, the last gig I did was the night before last. Mm. When I turned up to the gig, who should I find waiting for me?
Who?
But
who?
Van Elton.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Waiting for you?
Come to see me. He didn't tell me he was coming even. He'd come to see me, yeah.
Right.
But that's... Now becomes less impressive when I tell you that we've known each other since we were 16.
Right, okay. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really? Okay.
And that we used to be best mates, and so, you know.
Is that sort of before comedy for both of you, or before professional comedy?
Before he started doing comedy,
and did you sort of have a comedy interest back then, and not?
Sort of. We were both A-level theatre studies students.
Okay.
At Stratford-on-Avon.
Really?
Yeah. But when he used to do a tour, his first gig of the tour, he'd start off in the 400-seat Cornwall Coliseum in St Austell, which would be the smallest venue he'd play on the tour.
Right.
And he'd go out there and he'd do an hour and a half of material that he'd just written and hadn't even tried out.
Wow.
Now that's it's mind-boggling for me.
Yeah.
You know, to just write an hour and a half of new stuff and then go on and do it in front of 400 paying punters.
And he was a fast talker as well. An hour and a half for him is 3 hours for the rest of it,
exactly,
probably.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
But amazing. I mean, the man has always just amazed me with how hard he works and the commitments he takes on.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And the funniest I've ever seen him, I think, doing stand-up was when I saw him doing the studio audience warm-up for the Blackadder 2.
Okay, oh really?
Because he was just so loose and informal and just working off the situation as he was filling in while they were...
So you were there watching it, were you?
I went along as his guests to watch. Yeah.
Do you know which episode it was?
I couldn't tell you which one it was. It was one of the ones, you know, the Elizabethan one.
Yeah, okay, yes.
But I couldn't tell you which one it was.
No, wow.
Yeah.
I found it recently that my uncle and aunt went to Fawlty Towers being recorded.
Gosh.
And they just happened to mention it. I thought, why have you not told me this? You've known I've loved comedy for the last two decades professionally, and to just come up, you know.
Wow.
And I believe they said it lasted about 40 minutes, 45 minutes. And you can tell when you watch it, you know, the set wobbles. They don't really record it. They're just in at 7:30, you're out by 8:15, and in the bar by 9:15, you know. So,
Well, someone was telling me recently, actually, they saw a documentary about the making of Fawlty Towers, and they were saying how... you know, lots of things didn't work properly. It was all very, you know, informal and under budgeted.
Yes. And you look at sitcoms nowadays and everything's recorded three times, even if nothing goes wrong, just to give you options in the edit.
Yeah, there's more cameras,
And it just feels a bit like, I don't know, maybe we got it wrong.
Wow, Blackadder the Second, Fawlty Towers, old school encounters with our comedy heroes. Now, how about some old school encounters with musical heroes? This is a good friend of mine, the music journalist in his student days, Mr. Russ Bravo.
Yes, when I was at uni, I did do one or two interesting interviews with bands at the time. I was working for the student newspaper in Cardiff University, so it was quite a interesting time because it was late 70s, early 80s. Mm-hmm. I remember there was a lot of these sort of punk and new wave bands that were touring at the time. Would have been about 1979, 80, something like that. And at one point I got to interview Fergal Sharkey from The Undertones.
Oh, yeah, right.
And the weird thing about him was, I mean, I don't know whether it was just that it was in vogue at the time or it was a nervous habit, but he wouldn't go anywhere without a Rubik's Cube.
Really?
Yes. And
Fergal Sharkey Fergal the Rubik's Sharkey. Cube?
Yeah. Absolutely. And all the time I was talking to him, and this was backstage at the Top Rank in Cardiff, he was constantly twizzling this Rubik's Cube. I mean, I didn't actually notice whether he completed it.
I was going to say, is he one of those who can solve it in 8 seconds? Go, there you go.
I don't know.
Or is it, no,
I don't
he just
know, but
kept
it was,
trying.
It was, I don't know, it's just a... He had a tweed jacket on, I seem to remember, which didn't look very sort of Undertones-ish.
Yeah,
but then
yeah.
they were, you know, interestingly clothed at the best
did what
of
they
times.
Did.
He would just twizzle his Rubik's Cube. Other person I saw was interviewed was a guitarist called Alvin Lee. It's not everybody will know him, but he was a very big hit at the Woodstock Festival. And I wanted to talk to him about Jimi Hendrix, because Jimi Hendrix is a real sort of hero of mine, you know, fantastic guitarist and everything. And I thought, well, he will have, you know, played on the same bill as Hendrix, maybe he went and jammed with him or something, I don't know. And so I managed to get my way backstage, and Mr. Lee was prepared to talk, although it's probably fair to say he couldn't get out too many coherent sentences.
Okay. He was in a bit of a
he was
bit
yes,
of a worked up state.
He had partaken
of
something or other.
Right.
And there was also a young lady who wanted to see him, who was obviously far more interested in than me. So I had the slightly awkward experience of trying to interview a man while he was sort of being sort of met
by
a young lady who was obviously keen to go away with him somewhere.
Okay.
And
and interview him further, I'm
yes,
sure.
Indeed. Yes, indeed. So I was trying to sort of say, so what was Hendrix like, you know, as a person?
Mm.
And he would sort of go, you know, oh, yeah, he was all
right. Right, and that was the best you're going to get, yeah.
Oh, is it, you know, and then did you ever play guitar with them? Yeah, I probably did. And in the end, I had to present this interview, which I tried to embellish a little just to provide some content, because basically, you know, grunts can only get you so far.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm not, I don't think I've ever met a total music hero, to be honest.
Yet.
No.
Till now.
No.
Well, tonight, who's going to know he's not here?
Yes. So I think, you know, they normally say don't meet your heroes because you'd be disappointed.
Well, that's true.
Don't they?
That's true.
Who have you met then?
Who have I met? I had a. Well, my favourite band, as has been widely documented, is Swedish power pop combo Roxette.
Okay, yes.
And I nearly met them. I've seen them live once or twice. And I had the idea a few years ago to do a Roxette musical.
Right.
Because it was a few years ago now, Ben Elton had just done his like third or fourth. He'd done We Will Rock You, which was popular.
Yeah.
He'd done Tonight's the Night for Rod Stewart, which was less popular but all
yes.
right. And suddenly, like every band is getting one of these jukebox musicals. I thought, well, surely who's better to write the Roxette musical than a writer and Roxette fan, Paul Carenza? And so I slightly for a joke ahead of an Edinburgh Festival show, I thought I'll send a letter to their manager. If I get a reply, I can. Just make a little joke about it or something. And I gave the whole synopsis. It was going to be called Joyride! The Roxette musical about a fairground and runaway. All this sort of stuff was there.
Yep.
Tying all the songs. And she replied and said, sounds interesting. Okay, let's see if we can... I was going, oh, really? Okay. And she lined up a meeting for me with one of her contacts who was one of Sweden's leading... theatre directors.
Wasn't a member of ABBA, was it?
It wasn't a member of ABBA, no.
Okay.
But this guy is a theatre director in Sweden and knows them. And we met up, we had a coffee, we talked for an hour or so about my idea. I had to sort of suddenly wax lyrical about this synopsis that I'd sort of made up on the back of a beer mat, if I'm honest, and go, no, this is really good, yes. This will be really serious.
The thing is, people will really care about the characters.
Exactly, it's all about the characters, all about the characters. Without thinking, no, I've just made this up as a little jump between Fading Like a Flower and Listen to Your Heart. And he'd sort of nearly got going, so he said, we'll write it up a bit, and then I'll arrange a meeting for us and Pear and Marie, which are the two members of Roxette, and I never did it, only because I thought I could blag my way in front of him for an hour.
Yeah.
I don't think I really want to meet my two musical heroes and have to, you know, there's the stuff that you have nightmares about, having to ad-lib for an hour in front of your musical heroes about a show that you've really put no real thought into. Yeah. So for that reason... I've passed on meeting those heroes.
But, yeah. So that the Roxette loving public is still waiting.
They are still waiting for the Roxette musical. And if everyone ever comes out and I'm not part of it, I'll be really gutted. I should have done it.
Yeah, so speaking of Roxette, if you did listen carefully at the BBC Music Awards, and if you didn't watch it, what's wrong with you? You would maybe see a little mention of Roxette at 1 hour, 13 minutes and 40 seconds, but that's nothing to do with me. Now, I've been trying to nobble a few guests at the Music Awards, see Robbie Williams, see if he could get him on the podcast. That'd be nice, he's thinking about it. Kaiser Chiefs, they're going to get back to me. Craig David's interested, but he's checking his diary. He's busy Wednesday to Saturday, and he's... chilling on Sunday, but Monday, Tuesday look positive, so we'll see how that goes. Now, one thing I wanted to do, actually, though, was I have just handed in this Christmas book, A History of Christmas, and one of the things I did in it was do the history of the Clement Clark Moore's A Visit from St. Nicholas, you know, that famous "'Twas the Night Before Christmas" poem. So I've sort of put pen to paper and done a little poem about the history of the poem, if that makes sense. I thought I'd give you a little sneak preview here, ready for Christmas. Here we go. 'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the den not a sound could be heard but for Dr. Moore's pen. The man was a minister, preacher and writer who penned Hebrew lexicons, and now something lighter. He'd studied the myths of St. Nick worth preserving and borrowed ideas from pal Washington Irving. Now, Irving's depictions of Santa had sleigh with gifts and one reindeer taking flight Christmas Day. So Dr. Moore scribbled on Christmas Eve, this tale of St. Nick, new notions conceived. This jolly old elf now had little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly, and he'd gained extra reindeer, Dasher and Vixen, Prancer and Dancer, Donder and Blitzen, Comet and Cupid, and if someone's excluded, it's 117 years till there's Rudolph. It seems now the chimney is his favourite entrance, the easiest route to deliver the presents. And Dr. Moore changed the events by one day, so it's now Christmas Eve that Santa rides on his sleigh. The Protestant church still saw Christmas as Catholic, and Dr. Moore thought, well, this dating's elastic. Make it the 24th. Don't get embroiled in questions of Christmas Day rites getting spoiled. Now, the very next day, 'twas the night before Christmas, and Dr. Moore debuted A Visit from St. Nicholas. His children sat listening, a tale before bed, enthralled by the words that their father now said. 'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse, etc., etc., etc. So you get the idea. I mean, there's some backstory bits need filling in there. If you read the book, you'll get the whole picture about this history of Santa Claus and how this poem shifted Santa Claus' arrival from Christmas Day to Christmas Eve. But that's to come next year. That's in the book, which will be there next year. Lots of our podcast guests this week actually have books. You're probably just about in time to get it in time for Christmas, if you're very quick. If not, great New Year reading. Now, one of those people is our next guest, Stephen Colgan. He's been on it before, a QI elf, and what better time for an elf but for Christmas?
There's certain aspects of the show that get harder every year. Mm. Like the Christmas show is harder to do every year.
Oh, yes.
Because, you know, there is a finite number of fascinating and quite interesting things to do with Christmas. Yeah. Although saying that, 13 years on, we're still finding stuff.
Well, it's funny. So I'm actually writing at the minute it's been done before, but a history of Christmas, you know, sort of like a social history of Christmas. And every day I'm finding something new. Once you think you know the Santa Claus story...
Might have to have a word.
Oh, hello, you know. But you know, once you think you know... you know, how it came in and out, the pagan thing, or the Victorian thing, or Prince Albert, the Christmas tree, and then suddenly you unpick something else. And, you know, I mean, and also there's loads of, as you'll know with trivia, of course, there's all these legends and you know, you, once you land on a thing, like there's this thing about the guy who invented Christmas lighting was working in his at a switchboard and saw the lights light up. You think, well, brilliant. And then you read actually that 10 years before it looked like someone else did it.
Yeah, so, I know.
You know, you want to believe it, don't you?
But that's one of the really difficult things, again, with QI, because it's not intended to be an encyclopedia. Mm. It's not intended to be an episode of, you know, Horizon or something like that. But, you know, at the end of the day, QI is an entertainment show. That's why all the people on the show invariably are comedians. But the way we look at it is that, you know, everything's interesting if you look at it in the right way. Mm. So you can take, you know, a subject like gravel, and you'll find something interesting to talk about gravel, and the fact that it's a funny idea that gravel can be interesting, that sort of makes the show work. And it's but the problem is that if we do get something wrong, which doesn't happen often, but it does happen, you know, everyone's human, you get these rabid people writing it.
I bet.
On last week's show, Stephen Fry said this, and I know it's not true, and as if we're the sort of arbiters of what truth is.
And I imagine as well that facts must change as well. Things that were true in Series A
Absolutely.
Right now must be...
Absolutely.
Must have changed or something, I don't know.
Well, I had one particular incident on, not last series, well, not the one that's on TV at the moment, and one of the facts on there was relating to Felix Baumgartner, you know, the guy who did the jump from the capsule in space on the giant balloon, because the one record, everyone talked about the fact he'd broken a speed record and the altitude record and all those sorts of things, but the one record no one had mentioned was the fact that the balloon he went up on is the largest balloon that's ever been made by a human. So I thought, oh, well, let's put that in, little and large. And I had this fantastic graphic of how big the balloon was compared to things like the Empire State Building and Nelson's Column and things. After we recorded the show, literally, I think about a week after we recorded the show, Baumgartner's record got beaten.
Oh, no.
By, I think, a bloke called Alan Gardner, who basically did it very low-key, didn't have all this business with Red Bull sponsoring it and the big TV show. And that basically strapped himself to a balloon, went up even higher, and then fell down. So, of course, we had to run a ticker tape across the bottom because the way the show works, the flow of the conversation, if we cut that question out completely, it would not lead into the next question or the question after that, or even a someone referencing it later on in the show, and it's, God, and it's... that happens, and the other thing that happened was during the... Which series was it? There was a very interesting book, it's on the shelf just behind you there, called The Half-Life of Facts.
Right.
And it was all about... It's basically about a guy who went back through a load of scientific papers and ran a few sort of programs and algorithms to see how accurate they were. And he discovered that there is a kind of decay rate of facts. That's why he called it The Half-Life of Facts. And that things that, you know, if you look at scientific papers 10 years ago, there's X percentage of the information in them that's now wrong. If you go back 20 years ago, X percentage, it grows. And the further you go back, there's this percentage. So when we did the I-Series in information, what we did, it must have been, because that was about the 10-year mark for QI. So what we did was we thought, well, if in 10 years' time there's X amount of percentage of facts that are wrong, let's go back and look at some of the earlier questions from the earlier series, the A, B, C, D series, and see how many of those are right. And sure enough, the percentage was about right. So we ran those questions again in the shows and actually had... we actually had, you know, Alan re-answering questions he'd answered before, but now, of course, the answer was different.
And were there ones that people had been told were wrong before that now they're actually, it turned out, you know, sort of, is this the case?
I don't think we had one where the answer they gave on the day was right now.
Right, so you got no points necessary 10 years on.
I think the only time we ever did that was with Dara O'Brien, where he made a point about the triple freezing point of water or something like that, which we then found out was wrong. So we took his points away retrospectively the series afterwards. So he started the show on minus 20 or something. And he was like, what?
Poor fella.
So Christmas QI is on over the season, as has been the conclusion of The Apprentice. So while we're bringing back much beloved guests to the Heptagon Club, I wanted to get back Richard Woods. He was on our first episode, and he was the bronze place of the last series of The Apprentice, the runner-up. He was on the winning team more than anyone else in the history of The Apprentice, in fact. But once he did enter the dreaded Bridge Cafe.
You wouldn't know much about, I guess, because you kept winning, but the cafe that you end up going to, it's the tea cold and you've got to pretend it's warm. That's my theory. I reckon hours of filming, it's just cold tea.
I think half confirmed.
Okay, fair enough. It goes cold. Fair play. We're just talking about the temperature of tea, aren't we? Really?
Yeah, it just goes out. But it is proper tea, though. I mean, you know. But there's no real toilets in it, so it's. The Bridge Cafe. There's actually two Bridge Cafes. One of them is really shabby, the small one that you see from the outside with the Bridge Cafe on it, and then the other one, there's another cafe which is equally as bad. But I think they take it in turns because we book it out for a whole day, but they. Okay. Only purchase like 5 cups of tea, so it's not quite good financially. But with the real Bridge Cafe, you walk through the horrible kitchens round the back, and it's just an outside toilet in a wooden shed, and all the girls are in there like highly makeup, you know, trying to use the loo, and she's way too glamorous for even that part of London, let alone anywhere else, and it's just ridiculous. So, good fun.
More Richard in a moment, but Stephen Colgan is over here browsing the entertainment shelves, so I wonder what his influential TV was, the QI before QI.
Back in the 70s and 80s, a guy called James Burke on TV used to do a series called Connections, which was one of my favourite TV shows. It was extraordinary. He'd start off at, say, the Twin Towers in New York, and he'd talk about what's the connection between... It's quite spooky. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's on YouTube. The very first episode, Connections, Series 1, Episode 1, starts off with him talking about a plane crash and the Twin Towers.
Really?
It's really spooky. Although he's not talking about the plane crashing into the Twin Towers, it's really weird that he's standing there with this airplane going over and an airplane going, But... But it was all about, in that episode, he talked about, the guy who invented the electric motor and the guys who invented the black box and the guys who invented the structural shape of the buildings that you could have tower blocks. It's just extraordinary the way he connected everything together, and that's always interested me.
Yes,
so
yes.
I had this sudden inspiration. I'd been playing a game with a friend of mine who's an advertising guy called Hugh Williams, and we've been playing a game where he would say to me, but you can't possibly find a connection between... Napoleon Bonaparte and pygmy elephants, or something like that. And I would find it. And because of the rule we set was because of the idea of 6 degrees of separation.
Mm.
Well, it's not now, do you know that? Because of social media, it's about 3.5.
Is it really? Yeah. Oh, is it narrowed?
It's about 3.5 now.
Wow.
But because of the idea of 6 degrees of separation, I was allowed 5 intermediary stages.
Okay.
So I could go from fact to fact 1 to fact 2 to fact 3 up to fact 4 and then the final fact.
Right.
And it became a bit of a game. And after a while, I realised that these are actually quite interesting, these little chains.
Yes.
And then the real hallelujah moment came when I noticed that 2 of those chains were joined together.
Mm.
And then the second big, big hallelujah moment was when I realised that the end of one would go to the beginning of the first.
Okay.
So consequently, I then found I had a circle. You'd start with a fact, go around this little journey of facts all connecting to each other and come back to where you started. And
that's lovely.
That's a nice idea. So I thought, can I write any more? So I went away and eventually I wrote 30 of them.
Right.
And I thought, maybe this is good for a book. So I pitched it. I got an agent. I got a deal with Pam McMillan at the time. And it was originally, I have to say, I still prefer it to this day. I originally was going to call it The 6 Degrees of Rick Wakeman.
Right.
Because Rick Wakeman is one of those people, like Kevin Bacon, who's just phenomenally connected.
He is connected, isn't he? Well, the David Bowie thing, he was...
Well, that's right. I mean, he was the pianist on Life on Mars and Space Oddity, but he was also the pianist on Cat Stevens' Morning is Broken.
Oh, really?
Basically, any time you hear a sort of classic sounding piano in the 1970s or 80s, it's Rick Wakeman.
I do love that. It's, I know what you mean, those interesting people who do that, but they also did that, and it's not just they did that one.
Well, the other thing is he was one of the leading lights in getting comedy stores started. Oh, yeah, not the comedy store. Yes. I think in Jonglers he was involved.
Jonglers
in,
was involved. Yeah, that's right. We used to be on the TV Jonglers show. The only non-comedian who did that show. And
he's also connected with loads of different charities, and he also plays golf, and he's also quite religious as well. Plus, of course, he played with Yes and all these big prog bands, and he's just so connected. He just kept turning up all the way through the book. Some of my favourite facts are ones where there's a kind of incongruity built into it by connecting two facts that seemingly are unrelated. I mean, I love ones that I love the fact that Bruce Forsyth is older than sliced bread. I mean, isn't that great?
Wow. And that makes you think.
And it's the way you pitch it. I mean, that's what writing QI is about. It's not just about finding interesting facts. It's pitching that fact in a way that it gives the panel something to riff on.
Yes.
And makes the fact kind of sticky.
Mm.
I mean, the fact is Bruce Forsyth was born in A and sliced bread was first developed in B. And the fact that one is a year before the other or a few months before the other. You know, Bruce Forsyth's also older than Anne Frank.
Really?
Yeah, he was born the year before Anne Frank.
Right.
And it's really weird because you get that strange disconnect because Bruce Forsyth is still with us, but Anne Frank is something we think of as an historical figure. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
I love the fact that the pyramids were already, the Great Pyramids of Giza were already 1,000 years old when there were still mammoths wandering around in Britain.
That doesn't seem like it should be the case.
I know. I love the fact that, you know, the Wild West, when you watch those old Gary Cooper and John Wayne films, that's all taking place in the Victorian age.
Across the world, meanwhile.
Yeah, and in fact, the most, as we covered on QI once before, you know, the most popular hat in the Wild West was the bowler. Everyone wore a bowler hat.
Yes, yeah.
And virtually no status at all, except amongst sort of Mexicans. And
one of my offshoots is there's a website I set up years ago called themovietimeline.com, which I sort of let just do its thing. And it's, you know, kind of events, any event that's mentioned in a film listed, and people now sort of I don't even touch it now, people just add to it. It's got a bit out of control a little bit. But it started out with this, I noticed that while Al Capone was doing all the Untouchables kind of stuff, that exact same week, King Kong was meant to be patrolling around New York and squashing. And I think if that's happening there and that's happening there at the same moment, isn't that quite nice?
That's a big
to
news
think
week,
that.
Isn't it?
It's a big
good
week
to bury bad news.
It is, isn't it? It is. Camera would have a field day.
I think my absolute favourite, if you want one to end on, I think my absolute favourite of those incongruous ones is the fact that you could have gone by tube to see the last public execution by hanging in the UK.
Wow.
They overlap just slightly.
Really?
The very beginning of the tube and the very last. I mean, executions carried on until the 60s, but the last public execution. Wow. You could actually have gone to see by tube.
And then get the tube home again. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? Didn't I hear somewhere that France had execution by guillotine after Star Wars was out?
Yeah, the same year. The same year it stopped, 77.
That's crazy. How can we live in a world where Chewbacca was a thing when that was still going on?
Well, another extraordinary thing is that again, they were public up until, those executions were public up until a certain period of time. I can't remember what the year was now, but Christopher Lee, the great Hammer actor, was at the last French public guillotine execution. Yeah,
wow,
he was actually there
helping out, or just sort of researching a role, or just
looking for lunch.
Just had a ticket. Oh dear.
Yeah, now who knows how it actually pushed his career in that dark direction.
Yes, there, clearly.
But the fact is, he was actually there at the last public execution by guillotine.
Yeah, my movie timeline website is still available and findable online. Every film ever, chronologically organised for your browsing pleasure. Do have a gander. Speaking of having a gander, or indeed contributing something back, we do have a bring a bottle section. We like to invite our podcast listeners to contribute something back, maybe sharing something we've done online, liking us on Facebook, that sort of thing. This year we thought we'd give one further, though, giving back to our guests. So we do have, if you like our Facebook page, you will find there an Amazon wish list we've created of books available by guests we've had on the show. A lot of them have written books. So if you go to our Facebook page, find that Amazon list, you will see the big list of all of the books of all of our guests. So why not have a look there and maybe purchase one for a Christmas for a friend, if you're very, very quick, or indeed for New Year. You could have some nice reading from one of our guests. So why not give something back to one of our guests this week? That would be fantastic. While we're giving back things, we should actually give a big shout out, if that's what they call it nowadays, to, even though they're not listening, but Kermode and Mayo's podcast. I'm well aware we have sort of inherited the corner thing. We have Name Droppers Inglenook, we have the Trivial Cove Joke Corner, and Mayo's and Kermode's podcast do have these corners as well. So we're very grateful to them. And that wasn't a knowing inspiration to this, but by about four episodes in, I started to realise that I think they had that idea first. So a big, big thank you to Kermode and Mayo. And if you're not listening, well, you probably are. It's the number one podcast in Britain, I believe. So speaking of films, now I was just thinking about the blockbuster video revolution that we had years ago. That it means they're no longer on our high streets. We've lost blockbuster video. And it was a shame, wasn't it, Richard Woods?
I remember blockbuster used to be a day out for us. On a Sunday, we would go out and we'd go to Blockbusters, we'd get a couple of DVDs, we'd go to the shop, we'd get a few packs of crisps or whatever it is. You would then go to Starbucks, get a coffee and go home. And that used to be my Sunday. Yeah. And a couple of kids get in the way of that now. Yeah, but the fact there is no Blockbuster also prevents it. And it became sort of a really big routine. So I think we were one of the last people to ever go to these. Another thing, wasn't Blockbuster, wasn't it called Hits or something? And wasn't there one in Windlesham where the old wine shop used to be?
We used to be a member there.
Yeah.
We used to member there and in Wildings. We had the little laminated card.
You were an 80s baby. Well, did you just know?
Born in 79, I was.
Oh, so you weren't. Okay, so right. You'll remember. What, do you remember the film? Oh, it's going to be one of those really annoying things where I start a sentence, I can't remember what. It was a film where there was lots of kids in a music record store, and it was... I can't remember it now.
Kids in a record store.
80s, and it sounds very 80s, doesn't it, straight away?
It was, yeah, and it was like this.
With a legging.
Yeah, it was one of these iconic films as the kid growing up, and they're all working. Is it
Empire Records?
Yes, Empire Records. Brilliant. It's a brilliant film. Yeah, I would imagine Richard Branson as Virgin Records in the time.
Yes.
And it's brilliant, and that whole going to somewhere to go and live popular culture and be part of it and be able to acquire a piece of popular culture like a DVD or even a, you know, an LP if we live up further than our generation. And now where do you go?
iTunes. I know, this is it.
You're sitting on your sofa and you haven't moved.
Well, your record shop's coming back again and people go in there just to have, because it's the experience of going there and it's not just downloading the MP3. But
I'm an avid collector with more spaces filled with LPs than my wife is comfortable with, it's probably fair to say.
Fair.
And I just, I think the sound is better.
Right.
As a bit of a musician, the depth is greater because with compressed music on CD, you lose the top end and the bottom end. So you get, you know, the music gets kind of scrunched into a shorter...
So let's, and look, because I'm useless at this sort of stuff. So when you say top end and bottom end, do you mean like bass and... Anti-bass? What's the opposite of bass? Soprano?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, the treble end of things.
Okay, right.
But it's also, I think it's got a warmer feel somehow, and I don't know quite the mechanics of that. I'm not so technically minded, but, you know, when you stick a needle on a bit of vinyl and you've got a decent pair of speakers, you know, if it's a live album, it's like you're at the gig. If it's a really intimate little acoustic album or something, it's like the guys in the room with you. And I just remember it was much more of an event. You know, you would actually ask your mate round to your house to sit down and listen to the new Bowie album or the new Led Zeppelin or whatever it might be. And you really did, you listened to the thing. Yeah. You know, now music quite often tends to be while you're doing other stuff. It's on in the background, or it's incidental, or it's in the car, or it's, you know.
Yeah, they never quite managed to put vinyl in the car, did they? They never quite managed to get...
it'd be fun trying.
It would have been
nice,
wouldn't it? Yeah.
They did come up with decks that were vertical at one point.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You could hang it on the wall.
Okay.
I don't know how that works.
The needle would go on... Yeah, I suppose I could see it working.
Provided they found a way of it not falling off.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah, yeah. Bit of glue is what you need. How many you got then? What do you reckon?
I haven't counted, but I would think probably somewhere between 500 and 1,000.
Really?
I should think.
I was expecting like 80 or something. We're beyond 80.
No. Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, I would say. I mean, they don't actually. When you stack them together, 100 actually doesn't take as much space as you think.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Wow.
They do need thinning out, though. I do say that for the benefit of my family.
But what you'll do, you'll thin them out, and then you go to a charity shop a year later and go, "Oh, I'll buy that one back again."
Well, it might happen. I need to go to a record sale and have a good shift of stuff. But I mean, you know, the great thing is. There is a lot more interest in it now,
but I don't think that it is going. I don't think it is going back again. That's just like a nostalgia trend, which isn't through the younger populations, which means it will have a shelf life.
Well, true, and I suppose, you know, if the LP thing, there are this one or two record shops in Funky Brighton or in the vintage area. I can't quite see that there's going to be a retro Blockbuster video. I've got field players anymore for a start. We used to go along, and that's lovely. I remember when Blockbuster started closing, and there were all those bargains to be had. You go in there and
99p for a DVD. You'd have to bring it back.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I've still got a lot full of VHS. Going, what am I going to do with it?
Yeah, exactly. Rip it.
I'm going to transfer that lot of nonsense.
Richard Woods does speak business sense, doesn't he? I need to learn a thing or two. Here's why I'm begging you for ratings and reviews on iTunes. If you can bump us up the whole thing, that would be always nice, of course. Anyway, our seventh guest this week, Belinda Campbell. She's been on us before and talking about her father, who was a big TV producer back in the 80s, but he was also a writer. And while we are here looking at retro comedy from Ben Elton's warm-up on Blackadder II to Sir Jimmy Cricket Esquire. Be great to get Belinda back here with her museum, in fact. She's bought props about her late father, who was one of the writers for the Two Ronnies.
Well, on that pink piece of paper over there, that's all the work that my dad got involved with. So he did write for Dave Allen and other people as well.
Generation game.
Yeah, so he was very funny, my dad. But of course, I was younger, and he passed away when I was 14 or 15. So although he made me laugh, I couldn't tell you, you know, loads of different things he used to say to me.
It's a different generation thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I looked up to him, I idolised him, and he did make me laugh a lot. We made him laugh. And his sister says of him that he was a real people watcher, and he could write something very funny out of just normal situations, just make them sound really funny. So obviously he was good at what he was doing, otherwise he wouldn't have written for the two Ronnies and Dave Allen and people like that.
Groucho Marx.
Yeah.
Groucho Marx, that's old school, isn't it? Mike and Bernie Winters, Tommy Cooper.
Yeah.
Roland Martin's laughing. Yeah, classic
so
comedy,
isn't it?
So
he obviously had a talent.
Wow,
but
great.
I didn't, as I was not an adult, so I couldn't appreciate all his...
Yes, yeah.
But I do remember having the giggles with him. I just in Twickenham down by the river, a conker fell on his face and he was bleeding. We were all in stitches for ages, the three girls and him. And, you know, so he made us laugh.
And then
as
he
well
got
as...
stitches. Yeah. Wow.
So we were all
it's a great heritage to be part of, isn't it? And, you know, I mean, the two Ronnies for me is, I think, as good as it gets.
Yeah.
Love it. So there's a book here, More of the Two Ronnies, The Best of the Ronnies Dialogue. And he's one of the guys. That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah,
wow.
Really proud of him.
Very good, very good.
The last word this week from Jimmy Cricket.
Before we were talking about just many various names of, you know, Ken Dodd and other people you've seen and worked with. What the performers you've seen over the years, who have you found to be particularly inspirational or just downright funny or just... the best performers you've seen?
Yeah, I think Ken just is right up there. Ken and Bobby and Tommy, I just really love them. And I just think, are we going to see any more double X? They're so precious, you know?
They're rare, aren't they?
They are. Yeah, yeah. They are. And because I love that double. I was probably, if I had got a strip man, I probably wouldn't be in a double act.
Yeah.
Because then I can create the mayhem. I'd sort of do it now using the audience as a strip man, I suppose. But... Bobby and Tommy. I'm trying to think. Stu Francis. I mean, the Crankies are lovely too. The Crankies still. They don't. Obviously, they do their pantomime in Glasgow, but they're very professional any time I've watched them. But, like yourself, Paul, I really do love you and Milton Jones and Tim Vine, and I'll be the first one people say, well, what about you? I'll throw your names at them because you're clean. The whole family can watch you. You see, and sit and enjoy it. And that's so important, I think, really, for comedy to be wholesome and that. You know, it means you have to work a bit harder. But hey, that's all the better because then you're raising the bar for yourself. You know.
And indeed, next week's podcast has Tim Vine, Milton Jones are both on it. In fact, what a lineup we've got next week: Tim Vine, Miranda Hart, more from Milton Jones and Sally Phillips. It's the dream team, as if this week's team wasn't dreamy enough.
Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank
you, pleasure, Paul.
Now, if you like our Facebook page, you will see that link to the Amazon wishlist of books from our contributors. Do have a look there. Richard Woods' book is The Digital Trailblazer. Dave Thompson has a book. Stephen Colgan has many books. And do have a gander there. Jimmy Cricket even has his letters to his mammy and indeed his Christmas single, Santa Bring My Wellies Back to Me. I do hope that Santa brings you what you would like for Christmas. I'm hoping he's going to bring me a new cornea and indeed a working computer that hopefully won't delete podcasts as I'm about to launch them. That's always a shame.
Hey, you, has anybody said to you today?
So anyway, have a blessed break, a Merry Christmas, an awesome Advent, a nice New Year. Here's Rob Halligan's music to play us out. Oh, and while we're here, let's thank Sam Gould as well for his podcast artwork. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Rob, for the music. And Merry Christmas, everybody. See you in 2017.